नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। अयाजयं महाराजं याजखादेववर्चसः राजसूयेन विधिवत् प्रचेतसं इवामरा। The priests, as powerful as gods, performed the Rajasuya sacrifice for King Yudhisthira in accordance with the Vedic injunctions. Just as the demigods had previously performed it for Varuna. Sutye hanyabani palo yajakan sadasaspatin apujayan mahabhagan yathavatsu samahitaha. On the day of extracting the soma juice, King Yudhisthira properly and attentively worshipped the priests and the most exalted personalities of the assembly. Purport. Srila Prabhupada writes in Krishna, according to the Vedic system, whenever there is an arrangement for sacrifice, the members participating in the sacrifice are offered the juice of the soma plant. The juice of the soma plant is a kind of life-giving beverage. On the day of extracting the soma juice, King Yudhisthira very respectfully received the special priest who had been engaged to detect any mistake in the formalities of sacrificial procedures. The idea is that the Vedic mantras must be enunciated perfectly and chanted with the proper accent. If the priests who are engaged in this business commit any mistake, the checker or referee priest immediately corrects the procedure, and thus the ritualistic performances are perfectly executed. Unless it is perfectly executed, a sacrifice cannot yield the desired result. In this age of Kali, there is no such learned Brahmin or priest available. Therefore, all such sacrifices are forbidden. The only sacrifice recommended in the Shastras is the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. We are reading from Canto 10 of Srimad Bhagavatam, Chapter 74, entitled The Deliverance of Shishupal, Text 16 and 17. In the previous verses, Shukadev Goswami is explaining to Parikshit Maharaj, and through Parikshit Maharaj to all people for all time and all places, the greatness of this king named Yudhisthira. In this world, people are very hungry to achieve power. The more money you have in a materialistic society, the more powerful you become. Aishwaryasya samagrasya. It is told by Parasara Muni, the father of Vyasadeva, compiler of Vedas, that the Absolute Truth, or Bhagavan, possesses six opulences, or six excellences, in their fullest. And all of these attractive qualities that give anything or anyone attraction are only a spark of the attraction of God, the source of all. Like a sun ray gives off or releases such nice heat and light. But all that heat and light is only due to its origin, the sun planet. And to the degree there's heat and light in a sun ray, what is the comparison of the heat and light of the sun planet? So we see in this world, people, things, qualities can mesmerize and attract people. And these six opulences are beauty, knowledge, strength, wealth, fame, and renunciation. And having any of these to a large degree makes a person very powerful. We see the power of beauty, how even great conquerors can be conquered by beauty. The power of wealth. In today's world, people with wealth can, to a large extent, control governments and control the world itself. Knowledge. It's people with knowledge who are creating things like nuclear bombs that have such unbelievable power, wreaking fear of the planet. What to speak of the power of a doctor, how attractive that is when somebody's dying and miserable and suffering, they go to a doctor, and the power of that doctor's knowledge makes him very attractive, especially if he actually knows what he's doing or she knows what she's doing. The power of fame. Famous people need so much security. Just their name, just their word, just being recognized. And this power brings attraction and renunciation. Especially in India and in traditional societies all over the world, if a person has a lot and is still very humble, that's extremely attractive. So the nature of all life, whether it's in a plant, insect, fish, bird, beast, all varieties of humans, everyone wants to be attracted by something attractive. And everybody wants to attract others to ourselves. And it's through these excellences that we're attracted and attractive. But Krishna tells in the Sri Bhagavad Gita that all the opulent, incredible things that you see in the entire creation are hardly a tiny spark of my splendor. If we think something is strong or beautiful, or if we're attracted to knowledge of this world, what is Krishna? Whatever little beauty there is just little particles of Krishna's beauty. Because the soul is part of Krishna, the soul has such inherent beautiful qualities. Krishna tells in Bhagavad Gita, that he's the source of all knowledge. He knows everything past, everything in the present, and all things that are yet to come. And he knows every living being. As the Paramatma, he knows every thought, every action, every word that every living being has ever done, is doing, or will ever do. And he never forgets. Can you imagine anybody with that knowledge? Somebody just knows how to predict what the weather is going to be tomorrow. We think that's a very great thing. And it is a great thing. But why is it great? Because it's a little particle of Krishna's knowledge that somehow or other we all have to different degrees. So Krishna is all attractive. Yudhisthira Maharaj, as a human being within this world, he had the greatest power of anybody within this human condition. He was a king. He was like an emperor. He had just done something so historical, where every ruler, every king throughout the planet Earth, they accepted him as their superior. They were willing to follow him. And he didn't do it, you know, through political diplomacy. He didn't do it by putting sanctions on anyone who didn't surrender. He did it because people wanted to. Every king in the world wanted to be under his shelter, because they knew there was no inclination in him to exploit. He truly, genuinely wanted everyone's well-being. He was paradukaduki. He didn't care anything for his own selfish interests. Another person's happiness was his goal in life. That was his happiness. Another person's suffering was his mission in life, to alleviate it, because it was his suffering. He treated every living being in his kingdom, all castes, all races of humans, and all other species of life. He treated them all as his own children, because he understood that I'm not the king. God is the king. I'm taking this role as his representative to perform his will. And these are all his children, his subjects. What an incredible responsibility that is. Therefore, such kings are willing to literally lay down their lives and die, even for the most insignificant citizen. Because they're not seeing anyone as an insignificant citizen. They're seeing of children of God entrusted in their care. The famous story of Maharaj Shibi. He was an emperor. Such power, such fame, such armies, he was undefeatable. But when a little pigeon, and pigeons are not usually considered the most prestigious birds. If it was a peacock or a nightingale, it would be another thing. But it was a pigeon. How many pigeons do we see in any city today? A pigeon flew up to him, who was about to be eaten by a hawk. And he said, please give me shelter. You are my king. Shibi didn't see a pigeon. He saw the spirit, the soul within that pigeon was Krishna's child. And he didn't say to the pigeon, you're in Maya, you're not your body. You shouldn't be attached to life or death. So what if you die, the soul's eternal? He could have said that, and it was true, philosophically. But as a king, he was responsible not only for enlightening the souls with such good philosophy, but also protecting the bodies that those souls were temporarily living in. So he said to the hawk, "You cannot eat this pigeon. Myself, with all my strength, with all my mystical yogic powers, with all my armies, I will protect this hawk from you, I mean this pigeon from you." And the hawk said, "Well, you're supposed to protect me too, because I'm your citizen. And my food is pigeons." "So what are you going to do? You have to provide for me too. Don't be partial." And the king was so impartial. He said, "Whatever weight this pigeon is, I'll cut off my own flesh and you eat it." The hawk said, "Very nice. I don't know that much about it, but probably human flesh tastes better than pigeon flesh." So he was happy. So the king, with his sword, cut off a chunk of his own flesh from his own body, the size of that pigeon, put it on a scale, the pigeon on the other side, and the pigeon was weighing more. And he cut more and more flesh off, and the pigeon still weighed more. And finally, the king sat on the scale, and it was exactly his body, complete, was the same weight as the pigeon. And the king, he didn't have any remorse. He didn't have any fear. He didn't feel he was being tricked or cheated. He was just genuinely compassionate. Yes, eat me. No resistance. Now, this sounds like an extreme story, which it is, but it does reveal how for such a king, they're so detached that for them it's an honor to give their life to protect someone. Because he knew he wasn't his body. His body, as a ruler, was meant to protect. And to die for that purpose is glorious. Hari Bol. Sounded like, not exactly like a pigeon. Something like that. So such great kings as Yudhisthira Maharaj, Shibhi Maharaj, they see a child of Krishna within everyone's heart. And that is where they get such complete fearless detachment. Samsidhir Haritoshana, what will please Krishna? That's all. Life or death is only meant for that purpose. What will please Krishna? And they were taking such responsibility. So here is Maharaj Yudhisthira. He attains such a high level of power. He's actually fit to perform the Rajasuya sacrifice. Most difficult sacrifice. You have to have every ruler on earth humbled before you. And those who were demoniac, exploitative, and cruel, Yudhisthira Maharaj had to fight them. But for everyone else, it was their greatest joy and honor to be under Maharaj Yudhisthira. It wasn't a competitive thing. That why should your kingdom be more powerful than mine? That fear is only there, really, when either you're evil or when you're fearful, that you don't trust somebody. But all the good people in the world, or all the neutral people in the world, they totally trusted Yudhisthira Maharaj. They knew myself, my family, all my citizens will have the best position if we all accept Yudhisthira Maharaj. And he didn't interfere with anyone unless they were doing something that was against Dharma. Rather, he encouraged, he empowered everyone. In today's world in politics, to stay in power, sometimes the strategy is we have to disempower everyone else. But Yudhisthira Maharaj empowered everyone else. And therefore, everyone trusted him. Such a leader. So now he's the wealthiest man in the world. He's the most powerful man in the world. But Akinchana Gocharam, he considered himself in total poverty. Not just physical poverty of having no food or residence, something much deeper than that. He understood nothing is mine. Everything belongs to Krishna. I'm just the caretaker. This body is not mine. Manaso deho geho jo kichu mor arpilun tuau pade nanda kishor. My body, my mind, my words, my family, my home, all my intelligence, all my skills, everything, Krishna, son of Nanda, everything is yours. I surrender to you. What is surrender? Surrender is not some esoteric concept. Surrender means just to be honest. That's all. If you're honest, you're humble and surrendered. The honesty is everything does belong to God. Sarva Loka Maheshwaram. Ultimately, Krishna creates it. And whatever we can do, Krishna's given us our brains, he's given us our body, he's given us our intelligence, he's given us our skills, he's given us the sunlight and the water and the food and the air to sustain anything we do. So everything is Krishna's. False ego means to think anything's mine. My loved ones, Krishna, through his nature, has created their bodies. Their souls are a part of him, emanating from him. Everything. So to surrender is simply to think, to speak, and to act with that understanding. And Suhridam Sarva Bhutanam. Krishna is the well-wishing, intimate, loving friend of everyone. Not only is he the proprietor of everything that exists, but he's the supreme lover and the supreme object of love. He's the ultimate friend. So surrender means to have complete trust in God. And to be so happy that everything belongs to Krishna. Not to be competitive or envious. I want this to be mine. You're only like that when you don't trust somebody. But when you understand the beauty and the sweetness of the love of Krishna, then it's the most liberating situation that everything belongs to Krishna. And it's only in that state that we're actually not afraid of death. Because what is death? Death is when everything is taken away from us. And the fear of death is to the degree we think anything is mine. This is my body. I am this body. And we know that death could come not only any minute, but it will come any minute, 100%. Sure as death, Prabhupada would say. When you want to say something is absolutely certain, you say, sure is death. So fear of death, fear of poverty, so many fears in this world, fear of losing our reputation, fear of losing our loved ones. But abhay charanaravindare, we become fearless when we have complete faith in Krishna, that he's truly not only my best friend, but he's everyone's best friend. Even his enemies, even those who hate him, he's their best friend too. His love and his friendship has no partiality. But he responds according to what's best for the person in due course of time. So when we understand everything is the Lord's and the Lord is my friend, there's nothing to fear. So this is Yudhisthira Maharaj. This is what a Mahatma is. One who has this broad perspective. So now he is in a position to perform the Rajasuya Yajna, which practically no one could ever do. It's described here that the demigods perform this yajna for Varuna. That was the last time it was done. That's quite impressive. And Yudhisthira's a man in this little earth planet. But why is he doing the Rajasuya Yajna? For the well-being of everyone. Because his whole purpose of doing it was to give everyone an understanding of Krishna. So at this particular verse that we're reading today, the priests are performing the sacrifice, and on this particular day of the extracting of the soma juice, Yudhisthira Maharaj is honoring and worshiping the priests who are performing this ceremony. And it is described here, there's a particular priest that oversees everything. And he's responsible to make sure everything is perfect. They're chanting mantras, they're doing rituals and pujas for several days, throughout the day. If a single ritual is offered incorrectly, even slightly, if a single mantra or hymn, even for a moment, is not the correct pronunciation or the correct rhythm, then the entire sacrifice is spoiled. And it creates bad luck instead of good luck. And they could actually do it in that way. So they did everything perfectly. And Yudhisthira Maharaj is honoring them. And Srila Prabhupada in today's purport is explaining something that is greatly emphasized within the Vedic literatures. That such sacrifices, to perform them properly in this age of Kali, no one has the capacity. We even see in other ages, it was Tvasta. He was a very, very great Brahmin. And he did days and days of sacrifice for a particular purpose, to create someone who would kill Indra. And in days of performing mantras and yantras and tantras and mudras and pujas, he said one word incorrectly. And it's not that he said the wrong word, but what he did do is it was in Sanskrit, some vowels are long and some are short, like Vasudev and Vasudev. The difference is one is Krishna's father and one is Krishna. So that's quite a difference. So if you're talking to Sanskrit people, you have to know what you're doing. If you say Vasudev and you mean Vasudev, then they're going to think you're talking about a completely different person. So he said a long or a short instead of a long instead of a short. One little mistake like that out of hours and hours and hours of reciting perfect, and it had an opposite effect. Amritrasura was killed just because of that one mistake. So we perform yajñas and all of these things in the age of Kali, but we understand and we know that they can't really bring the desired result that we truly want. Therefore, yajñai sankirtana priyai yajantihi sumedasa. In this age of Kali, the only sacrifice that is recommended in the Vedic literatures for that highest perfection of life is sankirtan, the chanting of God's names. And those who really have properly nourished intelligence will understand this. What was possible to achieve in Satya Yuga by perfect meditation, in Treta Yuga, by performing of these types of yajñas or sacrifices. In Dwapara Yuga, by perfect worship of the Lord, that same perfection is possible for anyone and everyone in this age of Kali, simply by chanting God's names and glories. Harinama, Harinama, Harinam, Eva Kevalam, Kalo Nasteva, 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 Gatiranyata. In this age of Kali, there's no other way of that ultimate perfection but the chanting of God's names. Names of Hari. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is Krishna himself, who is the Yajna Purusha, who is the ultimate enjoyer and receiver of all yajnas, ceremonies, and sacrifices. He personally comes and extracts this essence of the Vedas and teaches it by his words and example. And in the 8 verses that he wrote in his life, the second is Nam Nam Akari Bahuda Nija Sarva Shaktis Tatrapita Niyamita Smaranena Kala Etadrasita Vakripa Bhagavan Mamapi Dura Daiva Midri Sami Hajani Nanura. That, my Lord, you are easily approached in your holy names. In fact, you have invested all of your powers in your name, your beauty, your sweetness, your love, your mercy, your strength, your protection. You have completely manifested yourself in full in your names. And you have so many names. And in each of these, true names of you, that you have revealed in different places throughout history, you are present. And then he ends the verse by expressing his own approach to chanting. He says, I am so unfortunate that I have no attraction for chanting these names. And we see Lord Chaitanya when he's chanting, what kind of ecstatic symptoms the world has never seen. His eyes, when he chants God's names, his beautiful lotus-like eyes, they weep torrents and torrents of tears, like the rivers Ganges and Jamuna pouring from his eyes. Sometimes his joints in his body become completely dislocated. His body trembles As he's chanting the holy name, sometimes his body becomes as light as cotton, or as heavy as the entire universe. His hair stand on end. There are pages and pages and pages within the holy scriptures, Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Sri Chaitanya Mangal, Sri Chaitanya Bhagavat, Bhakti Ratnakar, and so many other scriptures describing the ecstasies of Lord Chaitanya. He would fall in complete unconsciousness and there would be no symptom of life in his body for hours and hours and hours at a time. He would be in such an internal state of samadhi, and it was simply induced by him saying Krishna. And yet Lord Chaitanya is saying, but I am so unfortunate, I have no attraction for your names. That's because he understands the power of the names. When we understand Krishna's love and Krishna's beauty and Krishna's sweetness and all of that in his names, then we can never have sufficient attraction. For us, if you offer a little candle to the sun planet, do you think you're doing it justice? Insignificant in the presence of God who's appearing in his name with all of his opulences. And when some of us chant, we don't have this experience because we're not really experiencing Krishna in full when we're chanting. But Lord Chaitanya is. He's in such ecstasies and he's completely humbled by it in the presence of the ultimate, infinite, ever-expanding greatness of Krishna that's within the name of Krishna. I have no attraction. What are these little ecstasies I have? They don't do justice to Krishna. Trinadapi sunichena, the next verse. If we want to chant the name constantly, we have to be humble like this. And part of that humility is taror ibasihishuna. If we're actually approaching Krishna to taste the sweetness of his name, then we actually honor that every living being is a part of Krishna. And therefore we're tolerant and we're forgiving for Krishna's sake. We can offer all respect to others, because we want to please Krishna, and he's in the heart of everyone and everything. And through this chanting of the holy names, the highest perfection can be achieved by anyone. This is not something that's only in the age of Kali. It's always there. But in other ages, there's other alternatives. In Satyayuga, if you chant the holy names like Lord Chaitanya is recommending, you're going to get the highest perfection. But you could also do meditation and get that perfection. But in Kali Yuga, this highest perfection is so easily and simply available for everyone. And we see Dwapara Yuga, Treta Yuga, Satya Yuga. There was Jatayu. He chanted the name of Ram with love, and he attained the supreme perfection. He was a bird, he was a vulture. Treta Yuga is the time of performing yajnas. What yajnas did Jatayu perform? You know, they don't let vultures be the chief priests of Rajasuya sacrifices. He wasn't fit to perform a sacrifice. He was a vulture. But he attained perfection. And Maharaj Guha, he was by social caste consideration, he was an outcast living in a jungle, a nishada. But patram pushpam palam toyam yome bhakta prayachchati. Because he worshipped the Lord with devotion, with love, he attained perfection. So in all ages, whatever the process of realization may be, to serve the Lord with love is always the essence. And all these various methods and systems and processes are ways of developing and expressing that will to serve the Lord with love. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he made the acharya for the chanting of the holy names, Haridas Thakur, who was persecuted as an outcast by most of the society. But the great saints, they worshipped him, they honored him, and they loved him. And he was no one, he didn't see anyone as his enemy. He just saw every situation as an opportunity to turn to Krishna and chant his names. Yudhisthira Maharaj, in performing this incredible sacrifice, wanted everyone to know why he was doing it. Not because he wanted fame or power, but he wanted to give all fame to Krishna. Because we, in starting with tomorrow's verse, I won't be here, so I'm going to jump a little ahead now. The Agra Puja takes place, which is the most important part of this ceremony, where among all the assembled people, the person who is the most worshipable, honored, is worshipped at that time. Now, who's there? Brahma, Shiva, Varuna, the greatest rishis. We read Vyasadeva's there, Parasara is there, Vishwamitra's there, Vashishta's there, the greatest sages, the greatest rishis, the devas. And they're all so much the well-wishers of Yudhisthira. And now he is asking, who should we worship and honor for the Agra Puja? Because whoever is going to take this position, everyone in the universe is going to understand their greatness. So different people have different opinions. And it's described by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and other acharyas that the really, really, truly enlightened saints and devas, they were silent because they were actually humble. They knew that Krishna was there, but unless anyone asked them directly, they were just quiet. They wanted somebody else to get the credit. Great people don't want credit. Small people, they have this obsessive need for credit. Whoever were to stand up and say, Krishna is the one, it's going to be in the Srimad Bhagavatam forever. It's going to be in the Mahabharata forever. It's really... So for most people, even devotees, if they knew the answer, you know, they would jump up and try to jump up and give the answer before anyone else. But they were all quiet. Because they didn't want credit, because they were actually great sages and rishis. If they ask me personally, then I will speak. Let somebody else speak. So Sahadev, the youngest of the Pandavas, along with Nakula, he was asked, and he spoke, and he glorified Krishna, and almost everyone was really happy. All the great sages, all the great rishis, all the great devas. It was the happiest moment of their life. Millions of times more happy than if they said Vishwamitra. Vishwamitra is happy that they said Krishna. That's love. And then they perform the ceremony. Sahadev glorifies Krishna with so much love and so much devotion and so much incredible knowledge and wisdom and realization. And everyone, all the great personalities are smiling, saying yes, saying ki jai. Krishna ki jai. Jai Shri Krishna. And then Yudhisthira Maharaj, he's in such ecstasy, he's weeping with his eyes, tears of love as he's washing Krishna's feet. And he's drinking the water and putting it on his own head. And that means to really seriously humble yourself before someone. And then he sprinkles it on his ministers, and he sprinkles it on his family members, and he sprinkles it on so many other people. And everyone is so happy. What a celebration. The most prestigious, the most exalted, the most difficult of all ceremonies, Krishna is put in the center of everything. And at this point, Shishupal, he couldn't contain his envy. He was so disturbed. Just see how, according to our state of consciousness, we're affected by things. All the other great personalities that are there, and so many of the other kings, it's the happiest moment of their life to hear Krishna glorified and to see it. But for Shishupal, this was the most painful experience of his entire life.
Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells, ye yatamam prapadyante tams tataiva bhajamya.
That as we approach the Lord, as we surrender to the Lord reveals himself accordingly. So by hearing Krishna glorified by Sahadev, and by hearing everyone in the assembly, the devas and the rishis and the kings saying, ki jai, Jai Shri Krishna, by hearing them all say like this. They were all speaking with love. And everyone there seeing and hearing that glorification of Krishna was awakening the ecstasies of love. But for Shishupal, the same experience was awakening his hate. His hate went totally out of control. And according to this chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, he began to blaspheme Krishna. And he was calling everyone in the assembly the greatest fools for believing this, that Krishna should be honored. And Shishupal was very intelligent. By an intellectual perspective, he wasn't stupid. He was extremely brilliant. And it's described why he didn't speak up before the ceremony where Krishna was honored. It's very incredible analysis. Because if he spoke before, it wouldn't have the same effect. because they already honored and worshiped Krishna. For Shishupal to stand up and prove to them that it was wrong, that would have nullified and disgraced the entire yajna. You've already done a completely wrong thing. Therefore, the whole Rajasuya is a failure. You've all offended. That's how envious he was of Yudhisthira. He wanted to destroy everything. And he spoke so, and he was convinced of whatever he said. You know, when we have dramas and somebody plays Shishupal, you know, it's usually a devotee and he's just kind of saying his words, but Shishupal was convinced. That's the nature of envy. It can pervert our intelligence where this prejudice, this envy, this hatred, and the words and actions that in which we express our envy and our hatred and our arrogance can be completely justified philosophically, scripturally, socially, practically. That's the nature of the mind. He believed it. He was talking about how Krishna was dirty and he was ruining all the Vedic principles and he didn't follow any of the principles of Dharma and his family was a useless family. And he just went on and on and on and kept going on and on. And Krishna was completely undisturbed. He's sitting on the throne. Everyone just completes their worship of him and he's saying all these things. Krishna was indifferent. Describes like a lion is not affected by the screeching of a jackal. But the devotees couldn't tolerate it. They really couldn't tolerate it. And the sages and the rishis, they're peaceful kind of people. They blocked their ears with their hands and ran out of the room. They could not tolerate hearing this harsh, critical, terrible, hateful words against the beloved Lord of their heart. The yogis, the sages, the rishis blocked their ears and ran out. That's what they're supposed to do. Because there was no way to talk logic to Shishupal. He was burning in the fire of hate. But the kshatriyas, the warriors there, it's not their nature to run away when something like that happens. They picked up their weapons and started moving towards Shishupal to stop him. And Krishna saw what was going to happen. If there was a drop of blood shed in that whole Rajasuya, the whole Rajasuya would have been a failure. So Krishna told Bhima and all the others there, the Pandavas and the Matsyas and so many of the other dynastic kings, he just told them, just be patient. Then Shishupal really did the wrong thing. Krishna didn't mind when he was blaspheming Krishna, like a jackal. Doesn't disturb a lion. But then Shishupal, he started blaspheming like anything. The most horrible, cruel, hateful words against those who were Krishna's devotees, who were supporting Krishna. And that's something Krishna cannot tolerate. Injustice against him, He'll forgive. But injustices against his devotees? So things were building up. And now Shishupal is saying cruel, hateful words, lying propaganda against the supporters of Krishna, those who love Krishna. And then Shishupal raises his sword and his shield to attack the devotees. And while he was in his attack mode, it was going to be a bloody fight. And that blood would have destroyed Yudhisthira's, what he gave his life to achieve in this Rajasuya Yajna. So at that point, to protect the devotees and to protect Yudhisthira Maharaj, and in protecting Yudhisthira Maharaj, he's protecting the Dharma for the whole world. Because Yudhisthira Maharaj was protecting that Dharma. He was a compassionate person to everyone. So Krishna, as Shishupal was running to fight and kill the devotees, and he was a powerful personality, Krishna instantly, with his Sudarshan Chakra, he cut off the head of Shishupal with his chakra. And he did it in such a way, not a single drop of blood fell. His Sudarshan Chakra was going so fast, it seems like it just evaporated all the blood. And Shishupal's head just falls to the ground, no blood. It was completely, completely pure and clean the way he did it. The original amputation surgical procedure. And everyone was really happy. Except Duryodhana. Duryodhana was burning with grief and envy and hate. Because he understood how superior Yudhisthira and the Pandavas were to him, and he couldn't tolerate anyone being superior to him. He wanted to destroy them. And after Krishna did like this, and all the devotees were relieved, then something incredible happened. And this is an incident that is spoken about and glorified in so many different scriptural studies. In the seventh canto, Yudhisthira Maharaj asked Narada Muni, "How did this happen? Explain it, please. It's inconceivable." But we don't really see what happens till the tenth canto. And that was the Atma, the eternal soul of Shishupal, came out of his body in the form of a brilliant light. After his head was severed, his body and his head were laying on the ground. At that moment, his soul came out of his body, a light that was shining like the sun. And that light went through the air, and with such love and devotion, it entered into Krishna's body. This is mukti. He attained the perfection of liberation. First, he attained sayujya mukti. He attained the merging of the soul into Brahman, into the immortal Brahma Jyoti, the infinite light of God. And then he attained a liberation beyond that. His soul entered into the spiritual world of Vaikuntha to be an eternal, ecstatic, loving servant of the Lord forever. And everyone saw this. Here is the person who hated Krishna more than anyone in the world, who was constantly plotting against Krishna. And Krishna was always increasing his hatred. He hated Krishna, and he was totally mesmerized, obsessed, and attached to marrying Rukmini. And on the marriage date, the marriage ceremony, when all the kings, Jarasandha, Salva, everyone's there, all of his, you know, he invited all the people he respected the most and all the people who respected him the most. They were all there for this incredible marriage ceremony to show, he's going to show everybody how great he is. He's going to marry the most qualified person in the universe, Rukmini. His complete prestige was on the line in this marriage. What to speak of his own sensual, mental, emotional attachments. And right at the culmination of the point where everyone was there to see this marriage, Krishna nonchalantly just pulls up with his chariot, takes Rukmini and drives away. And Rukmini was so happy, she just wanted to be with Krishna. And then all the Rukma and others, they all attacked Krishna. And they were all defeated. So Krishna really knew how to increase his hatred. And so many other events like that. But here, Krishna is giving him what people perform yoga and study scriptures for hundreds and thousands of lifetimes to achieve. The perfection of being an eternal loving servant of the Lord and Vaikuntha, as well as included in that Brahman realization, total liberation from all material ego. He gave Shishupal that liberation, and the whole world saw what happened. And in this chapter, Sukadeva Goswami reminds us, he reminds Parikshit Maharaj, that Jai and Vijay, they were loving servants of Krishna, and they made a mistake. They said the wrong things to the four Kumaras, and they were cursed. Three lifetimes of demons within the world, Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha, Ravana and Kumbhakarna, and now Shishupal and Dantavakra. And they performed their service of being demons for three births, and now he's bringing them back to the spiritual world. But more than that, Narada Muni explains in the seventh canto, Shishupal was constantly absorbed in remembering Krishna. And even though it was with hate and envy, because Krishna is all pure, any way you remember him, you become purified. In fact, Narada Muni said, I wish I could be so absorbed in Krishna like Shishupal was. I guess I should end there. Is there any questions? Yes.
Hare Krishna. Maharaj, you said that Yudhishthira Maharaj was ruling so nicely even without having any political diplomacy to be used. But like, we have so much individual small arena, small circle of society and profession. In that too, it's like we have to act diplomatically sometimes. And personally, my question is that to act in a suitable way, one has to at least understand the psychology of the colleagues and the people who are involved in. So if you are not having that ability to know what exactly people want to say and how the things are, what could be the best way to behave?
Kala, Desha, and Patra, according to the time and the place and the circumstances, we adjust. But our purpose has to be pure if we want to truly represent Dharma and please Krishna. Diplomacy is not bad. Diplomacy could be very good. It just depends on what our motive and purpose is. Because Yudhisthira Maharaj, he exercised so much diplomacy. But it was always for the pleasure of the Lord and for the welfare of others. It wasn't motivated by envy or greed or false ego. Yudhisthira Maharaj, in his role of being a ruler, he exercised so much diplomacy in so many ways, and so did Duryodhana. But Duryodhana did his diplomacy for his own power, for his own fame, for his own selfish purposes, and ultimately his diplomacy was there to cause harm to anyone who interfered with his sense gratification. And Yudhisthira Maharaj's diplomacy was to create the best possible situation for Dharma to prevail in the world, for the pleasure of Krishna. So diplomacy is required. But what is our motive? What is our purpose? And what will the result be? Does that answer your question?
Partially, I had linked another question also.
You are diplomatic. Yes?
Trying to be simple, but I don't know.
Huh?
I try to be simple, but there are naturally some tendencies maybe there, because I... Just yesterday I was reading when you were writing that hypocrisy is a very fabric which destroys the saintliness. So, but I personally face this problem many times, that I really don't understand the intentions of people around. Even if I want to act in good intention, I don't understand whether their intentions are good or envious or what they are, and that cultivates insecurity within me to how to act and how the things are.
Whatever other people's motives may be, we should act with integrity, with a character that will please Krishna. We can have the intelligence not to be cheated by people. We can have the intelligence not to be exploited by people, but we should do it with integrity. Arjuna fought the battle of Kurukshetra with perfect integrity and character and devotion. So that others would not be usurped. So that the dharma and the goodness of the world would not be usurped by an evil man. So we have to have a strong spiritual foundation ourselves through satsang, through good association, through sadhana, through our spiritual practice. Then we can actually have the wisdom to act in this world, and even sometimes to be diplomatic or fight in this world, but for the true higher cause. And this concept could really be grossly misused, because the ego can label the most arrogant things, the most cruel things, as the highest cause. It's always been like that, people. That is why Guru Sadhu Shastra We have proper gurus, we have scriptures, we have saintly people who help us to actually understand what really is the highest cause and to live practically with that. Srila Prabhupada said, even if the most dharmic businessman says, for you I make no profit, you know he's going to make some profit. That's, otherwise you can't survive. If you tell your customers, you know, actually I'm making a really good profit from you, so you know, they'll buy from someone else. So these little transgressions may be there. But we're not trying to cheat people. We're just doing the needful. And what do we do with those profits? We're not cheating people. We're doing this morally. We can't all be cultivator Sridhars. And we live with integrity and character, and we use what we have for compassionate purposes in Krishna's service. And similarly, diplomacy. Raghunath Das Goswami, he was an expert diplomat, but yet he was the crest jewel of renunciation and detachment. And there are beautiful stories because he used everything for the well-being of everyone. So one more question. Yes, Radharani Devi.
Hari Bol Maharaj.
Hari
Maharaj, we say that Jay and Vijay, they actually offended the four Kumaras when they were doing their service of guarding the gates of Vaikuntha. And many times it may happen that when certain services are being done, some devotees may be offended because to keep up the standard of the service, sometimes somebody might be offended. And in your last class, last week you mentioned that while doing devotional service, if we have difference of opinion, then sometimes even that difference of opinion may be devotional service. But if you are in that situation, sometimes it becomes very difficult because you get scared. If you express your opinion, you might end up offending someone. If you don't express your opinion, maybe something which is not right may be done. So in that situation, what should one do? Take a neutral stand or be willing to express the opinion and take the risk of taking whatever reaction comes or whatever bad karma comes from that?
Hare Krishna. There is a universal principle, and then there are ways to apply this universal principle according to each particular situation we find ourselves. So obviously I cannot explain the particular situation because you're not telling. And please don't tell either. That way I get to just speak the universal principle. The universal principle is how I could best serve. How I can best serve Krishna. How I can best serve the Vaishnavas. How I can best serve the devotional society. How I can best serve and express my love, my gratitude, my devotion. That's the principle. And obviously the way we can best serve is when we are truly trying on behalf of Krishna to be a well-wisher. And in this world, we have to accomplish certain things to be a well-wisher. And in this world, there is always, and there always will be, and there has always been so many different opinions of how to be a well-wisher and how to accomplish things. The concept of unity and diversity is not that we all think the same. The concept of unity and diversity is not that we all agree on the same things, but we agree on a higher principle. And that's where we really have to find our unity. So when there is disagreements like this, how could I best serve in this situation? And if we consult people that we believe have wisdom, enlightenment, and high degrees of Krishna consciousness, and if we search our own hearts and motivations, then we make a decision how I could best serve in this situation. Sometimes remaining silent and neutral is the best way. Sometimes standing up and speaking what you believe very strongly is the best way. Sometimes speaking very mildly is the best way. How can I actually have the best effect in this situation? And the more we develop wisdom in our own hearts through realization, the more we can be effective. But this is the principle, to try to see the whole picture, not just the isolated event that's happening. Wisdom is to see every isolated little event in context of the larger picture. Just like your husband is a dentist. If somebody comes with some problem with their teeth, he has to deal with that specific problem, but he also has to see that when I deal with it, how is it going to affect all the other teeth? And how is it going to affect the future of the person? And you see it in that context. You see each part in a context of its relationship with the whole. So even if we're right, if the way we present ourselves is going to create so much antagonism and dissolution and everything else, then you may be right in a little way, but you're wrong in a bigger way. Yes? We have to actually use our good intelligence, our God-given intelligence. What is it actually that we're trying to accomplish? And what will best accomplish that? And certainly we shouldn't lie, we shouldn't cheat, we shouldn't do anything like that. We should have integrity. But we act and we speak in a way that's actually conducive to bring harmony and not dissolution. To create trust and not destroy people's faith. Because these are higher principles. And we should make our immediate decisions in a way that's favorable toward fulfilling the higher principles. And these are universal general principles, and that's all I'm going to say. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.